Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century.
Join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together.
Hey, this is Matt Tipp. Well, my brain knew to talk, but my vocal cords were not complying.
Cooperating.
They are now. I'm back on it.
When you get to be a man of Matt's age, sometimes your body starts breaking down.
You're using too much oxygen for a man in your condition. Then you need to take deep breaths, pace yourself. We have a long intro to do.
Long intro.
Oh, boy.
This is how you do professional podcasts, everybody. Matt Tebbe here with my friends Christy and Ben. Hey, yo.
Hey, yo.
Christy has a dog that's on the struggle bus.
You guys.
You were just telling me.
She had a stroke and none of her limbs are working. Like, she can't walk. But here's the good news. The progress that's happened is that yesterday she couldn't use any of her limbs and she couldn't blink and she couldn't use her mouth. And today she can blink and she can eat and she can drink. So, like, the vet is like, she's making progress. So the hope is that in a couple of days she'll be able to walk.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's sad.
Anyway, it's super sad.
I was thinking of making a joke about how some days I wish my dog could just do that instead of eating her own poop and constantly demanding attention. But that would be in bad taste, so I'm not going to make that joke.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Real quick, you guys, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
If you could relive one day of your life over again, either to redo something you want to redo differently or to redo something that you want to experience again.
Oof.
What would it be?
Oof. I need
That's a tough question. Yeah.
You ask the question. Why don't you answer first so that Ben and I can think a little second?
I'll pick a positive one. Do you guys remember the U.S. women's soccer team when they won the World Cup for the first time? And I may have talked about this with you before. Brandi Chastain celebrated by ripping her shirt off and like sliding on her knees in her sports bra across the field.
Yes, I do.
So a lot of people remember that because it's sort of an iconic picture. But that happened in the summer of 1999. And I was doing theater in New Hampshire at this summer stock theater. And that was like right around the 4th of July. And there was this huge 4th of July barbecue. We had a parade and then a barbecue at this person's house in the mountains who had a live band and ordered food. And I was there with my friends. And that day was amazing. Like, just from like fun food, watching the women's team win the World Cup. I was in the mountains of New Hampshire, at some millionaire's house. And then it was just wonderful. I think about that, I don't know, once a month. And I think that was such a great day.
Oh, so, I love it.
Yeah, that's what I would relive.
I'm going to go like total girl sentimental, I think. And that is, positive one. I think I would relive and redo like the day I got married. It was an awesome day. It was so fun. My photographer, however, got sick and sent a replacement. And Paul and I only have two pictures of just the two of us from that entire day from the photographer. And one of those pictures has his finger in it. It's like back in the day when you actually had film.
Yeah.
So like I have very few pictures of Paul and I from that day. And we didn't have a videographer. And I have thought at least once a year, I wish that it was like a movie I could watch so that we could watch it every year on our anniversary. So I would redo it so that I can record it.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
That's sweet.
That is sweet.
What about you, Ben?
You know, mine is also marriage related. my wife and I, to celebrate our 10th anniversary, which was many moons ago, 16 years ago, I think, 17 years ago, I think we're 27 years married. But when we celebrated our 10th anniversary, we had just had our fourth kid. And so we were, you know what I mean? Like we'd been, just keeping our heads above water parenting, right? And we're in our 30s. I think just barely. I think my wife turned 30 that year. Anyway, we'd had our four kids and this was our first time away from like all of our kids for an extended period of time without, that wasn't just like a date. And so we decided to fly out to San Francisco. We rented a convertible and we drove down Highway 1.
Oh, so fun.
You know, we went through Carmel by the Sea. We went through Monterey. We went all the way down through Big Sur, just with the top down, you know, and stopped at little tiny little bed and breakfasts, little places along the coast, and just like got reacquainted with one another. We really did, which was just an important time for our marriage. And it was just lovely. And so that's when I fell in love with California. So I would do that again. In a heartbeat.
That's fun. That's super fun.
Yeah. That's cool. That's cool. I'm sure there's some negative days I want to redo. But I like that we all picked positive things.
Yeah, me too.
That's fun. Yeah. Christy especially likes that. Yeah.
Right.
It's good.
Well, speaking of Christy's, we have a guest today, Christy Gutter-Sim. Yeah, she's on the podcast to talk about her book, Survivor Care, What Religious Professionals Need to Know About Healing Trauma. This is part of our series on trauma. If this is the first one you've heard, I encourage you to listen to all of them. We're trying to get our hands around what is trauma and how do we handle it? How do we deal with it faithfully? And Christy has been on the podcast now twice, and she's got incredible stuff to share about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into it.
Should we? Yeah, let's just do it. Yeah. Let's launch. Hit the play button, Ben. What do you do?
Listener, this is how podcasts work.
All we're doing
is recording an intro. I'm just going to send these files to our producer. He's going to edit them together, post it online, and then we're going to publish it. And then Tuesday morning, it'll show up in your podcast feed.
So, just hit play. Hit play on cassette recorder.
Hit play on the yeah. Here we go. Hitting play.
Dr. Christy Gunter joins us again on the Gravity Leadership Podcast. She's the Director of Client Services at an agency that serves families of domestic and family violence in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Christy is also the author of the book we're chatting about today called Survivor Care, What Religious Professionals Need to Know About Healing Trauma. She's earned a doctorate in global health and wholeness, a master of divinity, and a master of social work, and has over 500 additional hours of specialized training in violence, assault, trauma-informed care, and other related topics. Christy, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You know, we're going to talk about your book, and I just want to say right at the beginning that the book is incredible. The appendices, I don't know, there's like a half dozen of them, two dozen of them. I don't know, there's a lot of appendices. Those are worth the price of the book.
Well, thank you.
So maybe we'll, because she has one, Ben, and maybe we can quiz you here, since I know I read this book and I read the appendices, but she's got top 10 things that pastors don't know.
I like it.
They're most shocked to learn. Anyway, Christy, you work primarily, tell us about your primary clientele, who you work primarily with on a day-to-day basis.
Right now, I am Director of Client Services, so I am working with five programs, two domestic violence shelters, one in each city in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I work with a housing program for rapid rehousing to create sustainability. A legal team, we have two attorneys and two legal advocates. Advocacy team, so that you're greeted at the door, have all sorts of things that we do in those the advocacy roles, and also a counseling team. We have seven counselors on staff.
Wow. It sounds to me like you have five jobs, not one.
I love it.
That's great. So tell me a little bit about then how this book came to be and maybe why you decided to aim it at religious professionals.
Sure. So I did my doctorate research in healing after intimate partner violence. And as I was doing that research, I came across hearing several times over and over and over again, I told my pastor they didn't believe me, or my faith community just told me I needed to try harder, or reason after reason after reason. And not just necessarily, we decided not to say Christian professionals, we said religious professionals, because this also was occurring in lots of other faith communities as well. And so we wanted a book to be on seminary syllabi, to be a resource for ministry leaders, for anybody at faith leadership, chaplains, to have a starting point, and maybe we can cause a little less harm if we all work together.
Yes. Yeah, Ben and I, we've chatted about this on this podcast before, but it sure does feel like, and I know you have an MDiv as well. Is that right, Christy?
I have what?
A Master's of Divinity?
Is that
right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, we got master degree programs for training in ministry, and I never heard the word trauma one time, or the words domestic violence.
Right.
It feels like maybe until 2014-ish or so, that was okay. Like it was okay. Like most people didn't know about trauma, but it feels like the last 10 years, Christy, it has been another master's program for me and other religious professionals to get up to speed on what the heck's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've learned a lot about the brain in that last 10 years too, and how the brain operates in trauma, how it's supposed to operate, and what we can do to work with the brain instead of against it.
Well, I want to get to that. You have a whole chapter on that. You have a whole chapter on that, and it's fascinating, but can I back up a little bit?
Sure.
Because you have sort of spiritual degrees, and you've got more clinical degrees. How did like violence and trauma become a special interest to you?
Well, honestly, it's through personal experience, and so I lived in a domestic violence shelter myself, and I actually have it just fell behind my desk today. But normally, I have a paper that says Christina is a victim of domestic violence. She is currently homeless, et cetera, et cetera. And I keep that on my desk because all the decisions I make and all the situations I look at, I want that to be my lens by which I direct all these programs.
Mm. So that you aren't the expert, but you're like you understand intimately what these
people are doing. I viscerally understand in my body.
Yeah.
I've lived it, but I also did the work and went to school and studied it and keep updated in trainings. And so I balance the two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Christy. Maybe as we begin then, we're using this word trauma, and I think everybody comes at it a little differently, or maybe I like hearing, what do you mean by this? So we can fill out our understanding of trauma. So when you say trauma, what do you mean? What are you referring to?
Sure. So trauma is a response to a stimulus. So for one person, a response could be nothing, right? It didn't feel like anything. But trauma is this overwhelming, you can't run, you can't fight, you can't fawn, you can't socialize your way out of it, and you're just stuck, you're trapped. And so this is how we see some people are traumatized by the same event and some people aren't. Some people are trapped and unable to act and others aren't. Mm. And so that is what trauma is that moment where you're overwhelmed in your capacity to be able to respond. Usually there's a perception of closeness to death. And when I'm thinking of trauma, I mean both physical death, the literal death, and also a social death that can be incredibly traumatizing as well. And go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, this is so you're talking about then There isn't a list of traumatic events somewhere mm-hmm. that is true for every person.
That's correct.
You're talking more about how our body absorbs, interprets, and mm-hmm. reacts to stimuli.
Yes.
Yeah? So a parent who is verbally abusive mm-hmm. could be traumatic for one person and not for another.
Possibly.
Okay.
I am absolutely convinced, and I talk about this in the book, that there's no such thing as it wasn't physical abuse. Everything's physical abuse because it affects the brain and the body and how you behave and how you react. Mm. And so I there's no just verbal abuse that didn't make a difference. I'm thinking more, for 9/11, you know, all these kinds of events, you'll see some people who are extremely traumatized.
Yes.
And others who aren't.
Yeah.
Because we react different.
That's helpful. Mm-hmm. Thank you. You in your book, you talk about some of the factors of trauma. Like, how do we identify trauma, and what are the symptoms, or what are the ways it presents itself? Could you name a few of those that are like important to look for? Just as we become conversant with trauma, we can begin to notice and maybe name things that otherwise we wouldn't name as trauma.
So, are you talking about the internal experience? Those kind of things, because I have that kind of list. And then I also talk about external, what it looks like externally, that might yes. be counterintuitive.
Yeah, I think both are helpful. Both those yeah. lists are really helpful. Yeah.
So internally, I talk about how some of the most, I talked about the experience is overwhelming, perceiving you're close to death, but also this sense of agency is lost. Mm. You know, agency is the ability to exert influence and choice over what happens. And trauma is that moment where you don't have that agency. And so you lose this sense of agency and almost this trust in yourself because no action's imaginable.
Yeah.
You also have this sense of meaning that's violated. I have that on this list too, because your whole understanding of the world and how it relates to you is altered in extreme trauma. You know, it's usually an intimate partner or a family member oftentimes, and that really shifts. You start to feel isolated. Maybe you question yourself and your own competence, mm-hmm. and maybe even the divine's ability to act in the world.
Oh. Yes.
And now, a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Just speaking personally, Christy, it was my overreaction to not getting what I wanted and then learning that I was experiencing powerlessness and then learning why that elicited rage in me. Like, it was learning to notice that and name that helped me come to the point where I actually investigated, is this a traumatic response? Mm. And so that feeling of powerlessness, mm-hmm. and then whatever our body does, fight, flight, fawn, right, freeze, mm-hmm. it was really helpful for me to not just be like, gosh, I'm such a jerk. I have a bad temper.
And I think it's really important, if I could interject right there, that it's not a cognitive choice that we make to react to in this way.
Sure. Yes.
It's more midbrain. Cognition is these frontal lobes up here where we get to make decisions and choose. Yeah. The further down you go in that midbrain, amygdala, et cetera, you're reacting purely out of survival. It's a behavior that happens automatically without any thoughts. And yeah. I just did a training with my team here recently, and I said, you know, when we don't go around walking into walls, right? Because we've learned we don't have to think wall, wall, wall. Because we've learned there's walls there. We don't have to walk into them. We don't even have to think about it anymore. It's that kind of a thing where it comes out from that automatic response. I'm going to die. Something's going to happen here. Yeah. I got to react.
Yeah. Yeah, that kind of thinking, I think, has been so helpful for me to have compassion, both for myself when I react in those ways, right? Because I think I used to, the only way I knew to think about that was to moralize those choices, mm-hmm. right? And so for myself and for others, and so I would either judge others or judge myself like, man, why are you being such a big baby about this? You know, or that kind of thing. But realizing that's like, I'm not actually choosing to do any of these things, but there's a wound that's deep mm-hmm. within that needs to be tended to. That's why I'm flinching like this. That's why I'm reacting mm-hmm. in a way that feels like odd or strange. And it's been really helpful for me. So I appreciate you naming that.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Part of developing some kind of way to navigate the territory of trauma and abuse is learning how to name what is abuse. Mm-hmm. Like, how do I know what abuse is? Mm-hmm. And then what is maybe just disagreement or conflict? Can you do a pretty good job, I think, of mm-hmm. laying out broadly the basic contours of what constitutes abuse. Can you help us here then? How do we become people who don't call every hurt feeling abuse, but yes. are still able to name abuse and take appropriate responses?
So my definition that for abuse is any continual series of actions, words, or innuendos that devalue the humanity of a person through power and control. Okay, so there's lots of pieces to that. There is the power and control factor. That's the most important. If you've got two people claiming they're abused, who holds the power? Who's objectified? Who feels like they have no choice in their behavior? Who feels like they have no control over their life? So that's one. And then also this devaluing of their humanity, this dehumanization piece, mm-hmm. where the person isn't a person and they're an object, right? Mm-hmm. No, Lundy Byencroft calls it no different than kicking a stone in the driveway. Mm-hmm. And then also this continual series, right? It's a pattern, right? Yeah. It's not just one time punching in the face. There's a pattern and a habit of devaluing a person through power and control.
Yes. Yes. Maybe this is why, another reason why you wrote this to religious professionals, because mm-hmm. the church environment has a baked in hierarchy of power and control, right?
Yeah.
And so this is something that maybe as a young pastor, like 20 years ago, I couldn't see the power I carried as a pastor. I didn't appreciate how powerful I really was, regardless of if I was lording it over people or domineering. Regardless of how I behaved, sort of there was some kind of, maybe much like a therapist or a social mm-hmm. worker, there's inherent power in the relationship with people we work with. Can you share a little bit about how power and privilege operate in churches and what pastors should know maybe about their power and how that relates to trauma?
I think you generally summed it up pretty well there, that the position itself comes with power, and you know, he or she who holds the power holds responsibility as well. Mm-hmm. And the words, the things that we say from these positions of power can do serious harm, or they can do healing words. And so when I had a pastor tell me once that that my suffering of this abuse was God's gift to me to help me to learn something. Mm. And that caused a lot of damage for a long time.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to remember that, you know, I'm not the only one. This happens a lot. We don't understand that we can use our power to create opportunities for healing and wholeness.
Yeah. And I'm assuming you mean this is personal conversations, but it's also like what we preach about,
yes.
right? Like the whole gamut, like we can cause harm even inadvertently. You know, I think that pastors with the best of intentions mm-hmm. can cause harm if they're not sensitive about how they frame issues. So, you know, what that pastor told you, it sounds like that was a personal mm-hmm. conversation, but saying something like that from the pulpit, where you're trying to, like, you know, wrap your maybe theological mind around, well, what does suffering mean? And we're trying to be comforting, but we actually cause harm. Like I think we need to be sober minded about that.
And I've seen it in jokes a lot too. There was somebody once who joked from the pulpit that about divorce. And I was like, I burst into tears. I didn't want to get divorced. That is not my plan for my life.
Yeah.
So I think there's and then there was another situation where somebody made a joke about marrying off their daughter. You know, like these kinds of things have different layers to them to yes. someone who's been abused.
Yes. Yeah.
I just remember this. I was at a golf outing last Thursday and someone made a domestic violence joke to me. Oh. So it was like 95% men. Uh-huh. And we were talking about hitting a golf ball or something. And somebody made a joke about like hitting women. Uh-huh. And it wasn't super overtly gross, meaning like, you know, I'm going to punch a woman in the face. It wasn't something like that. Sorry. We're going to put a trigger warning at the beginning of this podcast for anybody to listen. But I remember immediately noticing it, Christy, and being like, you know, you could tell that joke in 1993.
Shouldn't.
But you could. You know what I mean? And you could do it on primetime television, maybe even. But you just can't do that in 2023. And I think... I'm noticing too, just in your story about the pastor, like you say, hey, I'm suffering physical abuse. And the response is, God can use abuse for your growth. Mm-hmm. Right? What I like about your book is it's not just focused on how to identify the problem, but you know, some of the largest words on the cover is healing trauma. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so can you maybe use that interaction if it's not too personal? What does that Christy need in that moment from that religious professional to begin healing from trauma?
So I think one of the first things is admit that you're not a trained therapist, right? So you don't want to go into this as a religious professional if you don't have the training and the licensure like you do. That's the first thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Second thing is it's not hard to be empathetic, compassionate, and connect with people when they're hurting and crying in front of you and saying, you know, this is happening to me. It doesn't take a lot of effort to say, wow, I'm really sorry.
Yes.
That sounds like it's really hard.
Yes.
Just that validation that I'm not crazy. It's not in my head. Because here's the thing. People who are abused would love to be actually. Like, maybe I'm making it all up. That'd be fantastic. Because then it would be in my power to fix it.
Right.
But when it's not, you have a hard time believing it yourself, right? You need other people to believe it too.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's when you say it out loud, Christy, it sounds really simple. But I just want to highlight that because it is simple, but I think that so many, just speaking as a religious professional, there is so much pressure that I feel, and I don't know where this all comes from, but there's so much pressure that I feel to have an answer or to like fix a problem or to, you know what I mean? To make just like put a Band-Aid on this, like make somebody feel better. And you know, that some of that's probably just personal stuff, but some of it I think is a cultural kind of, you know, expectation that we sort of pick up, like, oh, if somebody shares something with me, like the most important thing is for me to like help them wrestle with it theologically, when it's actually the most important thing is make sure they know they were seen and heard, empathize with them, validate their experience, and then go from there. Who knows what they need after that, but start there. I just want to emphasize that, highlight it.
One of the things I picked up the most from social work is to lean into the discomfort. Sometimes that means silence, and silence doesn't feel good.
Yes.
I can remember in one of my internships, I had a kid who had just lost a family member that I was working on counseling with.
Yeah.
And he made me sit there for 15 minutes and not say anything. And now suddenly everything seems easy. but there's something about that silent moment that makes us feel like we have to resolve it and fix it.
Yeah.
But that's not always what's needed. That kid just needed me to sit there and hold the space.
Yeah.
And that's the action, is holding the space, the container for the feelings, and to let people be felt.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I love the fact that you're saying, like, know your limits and validate their pain. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking too of the times in ministry when I've failed to see trauma. Usually isn't when someone is hurting. It's usually when somebody is angry. Yes. I think for me, this is just for me, it's so easy to take other people's anger personally, especially when it's directed at me, especially when it's full of you did this and you did that and you did this and you did that. And something that your book is making me want to explore more, this isn't totally foreign, but is to just remember that usually it's not about me, right? I can still be a jerk, right? But usually it's not about me. And many people are reacting out of something that they're not in control of.
Right? And the people you feel safest with are the people that you want to let that out at.
Yeah.
You know? Yep. So maybe it's really a compliment.
It could be. Yeah. It could be a good sign even. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit about domestic violence and abuse. Because I have this hunch. I don't know if you've looked into this, Christy. You obviously would know more about this than me, so I'm sure you have. But I don't think it's on many pastors' radar.
I don't. There's been research done on it. I used to have files and files of it when I worked constantly with the religious community, but most don't really think about it. It's 1 in 3 women. 1 in 4, depending on where you're looking. And yes. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So this is a perfect time to.
Here we are.
Be doing. Yeah.
Yeah. So 1 in 3, 1 in 4, that's bananas. Right.
That's supported. Right. I sit with people who say, yeah, I would say not that many who have sat in my chair and told me about the abuse have actually reported the abuse. So it's 1 in 3, 1 in 4 reported.
Yeah.
So I wonder then, as a pastor, as somebody who wants to be able to face this domestic violence and abuse, because I think most pastors think, you know, these are all Christians, right? Nobody's physically or verbally abusing anybody else here, right? But it's just not true. It's just not true statistically. So how do we then begin to develop a culture that where it's not verboten or taboo to bring up things like domestic violence and abuse? And then how do we begin to notice and recognize signs of it?
I think some of the greatest ways is to use October as Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Put stuff in the bulletin. Partner with your local agencies. There are some amazing agencies that are doing this work every day and are the experts in this. They'll probably come and talk and do a little segment. We have an education team that goes out and does talks and whatever, gives out information. Sometimes they'll have little cards with information that you can give people, put on the back of bathroom doors. And then when you're preaching, remember through the lens of what it would be like for someone abused. So maybe even tipping your hat to that, you know, as you're preaching a certain passage, remembering that not in every case, right? You know, putting caveats or disclaimers when you make grandiose statements about, you know, marriage should be for life.
Yes.
You know
yes,
what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, yes. I've remembered a few times as a pastor, and this is a confession. Ben, I know you want to get in here. We do not want to make
him angry. Well, I do want to hear your confession.
We do not want to make him angry, Christy, because it's just not pretty. I'm just kidding. I remember essentially calling Christians to stop focusing on other people's stuff, whether it's a sexual promiscuity or whether it's, you know, militant Muslims, whatever we want to focus on out there. And I've remembered using divorce statistics to do it.
Mm.
Right? Basically saying like the divorce rate for Christians is the same as the divorce rate for non-Christians. Mm-hmm. Right? And we actually think it's a covenant, you know. And I'm not explicitly thinking, I know what'll shame domestic abuse survivors. I'll bring up their divorce and hold it over there. I'm not thinking that at all.
Right.
I'm thinking like, Christians, stop scapegoating other people. Let's focus on our own marriages, our own unions. But that comment, that way of framing it without, like you said, acknowledging or seeing that person can do some damage in their life.
Yeah.
Right? It preys upon the shame they already feel maybe because of the stigma.
Yeah.
So anyway, thanks for sharing that, Christy.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
You are forgiven and absolved.
Yes, thank you.
Priestly duty.
Yeah, yes. Thank you for doing that. It's wonderful. Matt needs to be forgiven often for things. And so this is really helpful. No.
It's such a burden on Ben. I'm sure he's glad that you
this guy
carried his cross for a few moments, yeah, Christy. No, that's
I'm very grateful. No, joking. All joking aside. I think as a preacher, you know, and a pastor, I think one of the things I'm taking away that I hope if there are, you know, preachers and pastors listening, one of the exercises that good preachers do, I think, is they think about who they're talking to, right? I'm not just putting a sermon on the internet. I'm talking to people in a room and I know these people. We go, you know, we have a life together. These are people in my congregation. And I think it's worth remembering, this is what I'm taking from what you're saying. It's worth remembering that I don't actually know everything about the people that I'm talking to. And there may be people who carry all kinds of secrets, right? And so domestic abuse, violence being one of those things, that maybe there's somebody that I'm talking, maybe there's a visitor, maybe there's somebody out there who is suffering and who hasn't spoken up. And if I can just keep them in mind, it'll help me not to say something harmful. Mm-hmm. But on the positive note, I think it could also help them, help give them the courage maybe to speak up and to seek help. You know, if they can hear from somebody who's preaching that this isn't normal and it's not right and you shouldn't, that's not your fault. Like whatever it might be, can be maybe that is the nudge that they need to say, you know what, I got to get out of this, or I got to talk to somebody, or I got to figure this out.
Speaking on that line, if I could just add one thing real quick before I forget it.
Sure.
Several pastors have said to me, they came out to me, they decided they wanted to get out. I took them to shelter and they're just back with it. I did it. I tried.
Yeah.
I'm sick of this. When on average, it takes someone 7 times to leave. And so I call those first 6 practice. You practice leaving. You see if you can make it on your own, and maybe it's not safe, so you come back. I always want pastors and religious leaders to know that too, that I have 2 masters and a doctorate, and it took me 5 times to leave, right?
Gosh.
It takes time.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Respero. Hey, we've talked about them before. They're an organization that offers faith-based counselor training. They believe that the aim of counseling is real transformation, not just symptom management or removal. Their counselor training courses equip you to help people to be great lovers of others, to understand why they do what they do, to be emotionally healthy, and to live out their identity as someone deeply loved and delighted in by God. All their training is rooted in the belief that Jesus is a source of life and that we can be a part of his work of healing and restoration.
And for pastors and ministry leaders, their training is a proven way to identify the people in your church who might be gifted for lay counseling. And it can be a powerful way to help make your church into a genuine healing community. They provide all the training and the supervision that allows your leaders to do great work and to free up pastoral staff from needing to do all the pastoral counseling in your church. If you are interested, you can go to respero.org, that's RESPERO.org, and click on the counselor training tab.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to our interview we did with Justice Revival, Ben. We talked about the Equal Rights Amendment.
Oh, right,
And part of that conversation was about how difficult it is for a woman to leave an abusive partner, domestic partner, because of the economic and living situations. And somebody just today said to me, this is bananas. Like, in some states, it wasn't until the late 1970s that women could have credit cards in their name.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Right.
And so now we have all the, and the shelters didn't start until about that time either. And it was a, you know, this is not an old movement. This is a fairly new thing of, of being able to provide safe housing and stability for women.
Yes.
Oh, and men when necessary.
And men. Sure. Yeah. Yes. Well, maybe as we wind down here, Christy, I'm wondering if you can think about, and maybe it's even in your own practice, these teams you lead that you mentioned, like having like a welcome team that welcomes people into who may be experiencing trauma. What are some commitments or practices or habits that you cultivate culturally that create an open, welcoming, inviting, safe space for people dealing with trauma?
That's a loaded question. lots of things. I probably won't even think of a third of them just right now. We have our entryway is comfortable. We try to make it smell nice. But you have to be careful with the smells too, because that can be a trigger. We try to make sure that everyone feels welcome and not just a particular type of person. We have multiple languages available, not just English. We have diversity in our staff. Those are some of the ones I can just think of right off the top of my head.
Yeah. I think this topic, Ben, keeps coming up with Christy about seeing people.
Yeah.
And seeing people and learning how to see people that aren't obvious to you or aren't explicit in front of you. And I think that part of my awakening to trauma in these last 10 years has been, yes, this is how quoting that divorce statistic would be received by somebody who had the choice between being abused or getting a divorce. Right. And I just didn't know they were in the room.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were there. Right. One of the things I'm taking away from this is like learning how to see beyond what's obvious to you.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
And in the book, I talk about a few signs and symptoms of what to look for.
Yes, you do.
Yes. That's helpful to know as well. What were you going to say, Matt? Sorry.
I was going to ask, what are you picking up? What are you noticing that you want to name?
I think it's just sort of, I'm feeling this as a pastor, And yeah, just sort of feeling that weight of not just feeling the, it's a good weight. I feel like it's a good yoke, to take on. Just that my job is not only to respond to the people who are in front of me or the person, the survivor who does come to me, but also maybe to have a lookout, right? Right. To be a, I don't know, the metaphor I'm getting is from the Old Testament, like a watchman on the walls, like somebody who can spot maybe when something is going wrong and maybe ask a question or pull somebody aside. And so anyway, I'm feeling I'm feeling this reminder, this kind of weight, this responsibility to watch for people who might be being harmed, who maybe don't even know that they're being harmed, right?
I was going to say that. Maybe they don't even know yet. Maybe it's not in their awareness yet.
Right. And so, yeah, kind of what I'm taking away.
Yeah. I mean, just to put an exclamation point on that, Christy, I was an adult when I realized that yelling at people was abuse. Mm. Because that's the only way my family knew how to, like, you know, you didn't really care about anything until you started yelling about it.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the family dynamic I grew up with. Mm. And then I realized, oh, people don't like it when I yell at them. Mm. You know, I mentioned the appendices, top 10 things pastors are most shocked to learn, top 10 things not to say to a survivor of violence, top 10 things to say to a survivor. I mean, it's worth the price of the book in and of itself, Christy, because sometimes we default to like pithy tropes, mm-hmm. right? And I wonder, maybe as we close, one of them is like, I think two things are true. We can all agree as Christians that we have been forgiven and it's Christ-like to forgive. And number two, forgiveness is used as a cudgel to harm people who've suffered abuse. Can you speak a bit to, as a pastor, someone who longs for people to experience forgiveness, extend mm-hmm. forgiveness. How do we misuse the demand to forgive in these situations?
I have so much to say on the topic of forgiveness. One of these days, I'm going to need to write an article, because forgiveness is what happens when two equal parties come together on the same level. Mm-hmm. There are some ways, or there are some situations where you can do the very best you can. I forgive as much as possible, but that person can still hurt me, and I have to be on guard. Mm-hmm. That person can still take away my kids. That person can still drag me through court proceedings. I still have to be on guard.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really wise to remember that pushing people into forgiveness that's not healthy for them or healthy for their survival, not just survival like living day to day, but survival towards healing. I think we were pushing people into this concept of forgiveness when what they really need, I can remember I had a pastor once, she was amazing. She was amazing. And she said, you know what? It's okay if you want to hate him. It's okay. I don't care. You're allowed to do that in front of me. It's okay if you want, wish he was dead. That's fine with me too. And I can remember reacting like, no, I don't want those things. But she gave me permission to be where I was and not force forgiveness long before I was ready.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's such a beautiful thing. We talk a lot about God being so real that he meets us right where we really are. And Christians spend a lot of time denying feelings, denying their reality in order to be moral. And what we see, I think, from Jesus, what we're trying to recover from Jesus is this incredible permission to be where you really are, because that is ground zero for healing and transformation, right? So repression of hate doesn't heal hate, right? Another way to say that. You have to actually face it. Befriend it if you have it. Anyway, Christy, this has been a delight. Your work is really important to the church. Yeah.
Thank you.
Appreciate you sharing parts of your story with us and also writing this excellent book. The title again is Survivor Care, What Religious Professionals Need to Know About Healing Trauma. Christy, you have a personal website. You want to share that so people can find you online?
Sure. It hasn't been updated in a while, forgive me, but it's drchristysim.com.
Yeah. Sometimes I don't update my personal website either. Thanks so much for being with us again on the podcast today.
Thank you.
It was all I could do, Ben, not to read the top 10 things pastors are most shocked to learn.
Yeah. Why didn't you? Why did you feel the compulsion to not do it?
I wasn't compelled not to do it. I just chose not to. I took dominion of my body and exercised self-control.
Okay.
But now I want to read them. Okay. I want to read them now. Yeah. I'm bringing
it
up because...
Is that why you did it? You wanted to do it later?
I just want to see how dark. I want to see how shocked you are as I read this.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. All right. Listeners can't see my face, but I'll try to make some shocked noise. I'll try to indicate audibly
how shocked you are.
My shock level. I'll try to do that.
Okay. So I'll read them, but I won't read how she expands on them. So, okay. And this is one of, I just counted. There's appendix A through M in this book. There really are a lot of useful appendices. All right. Number one. Many incidents of abuse are not illegal.
I'm trying to express. I think level five.
Okay.
Level five out of 10.
Physical abuse is much more than being punched, shot, kicked, or stabbed. Number three.
Yeah. She mentioned that a little bit.
This is one.
That's fascinating.
This is the one. Number three is one I wanted to ask her about, but I didn't. Again, self-control. Good job, me. Number three, couples counseling is not a good idea when power and control is an issue.
Yes.
This is huge.
Yep.
Number four, the forensic exam is more about medical care than collecting evidence. Number five, the consequences of violence, even death, are the result of the offender's actions and no one else's.
Yes.
Number six, protection orders require additional effort to obtain approval.
Additional beyond?
Like extensive paperwork.
I see.
And
it's hard. It's hard to do.
It's like hard to get
ready to. Yeah. Okay.
Number seven, forgiveness is one of the most painful topics for victims. We touched on that a little bit.
Yes.
Number eight, most crimes of domestic violence and sexual assault are not reported or prosecuted. She has here, one of my colleagues is an adult women's domestic violence counselor, and she guessed that only about 10% of the women that sit in her chair have ever reported that violence to have happened. 10% of the people in a domestic violence counselor chair have reported it. Yeah. How many less who aren't sitting in a chair?
Right. So it never got to that point for them that they felt like they had to do something that drastic. Yeah.
Here's one that did shock me, Ben. Protection orders, divorce decrees, and custody arrangements should be kept on file in the church office.
Oh. Interesting.
Yeah.
Just to maybe if you have to prove something or?
If there's an active protection order, the police will need it if they're called to the scene.
Oh, interesting. There's
a custody arrangement. The child's department needs to know about it. You know, all this stuff.
Interesting.
You know, like if somebody drops the kids off at kids ministry.
Right. And then tries to pick them up or slick somebody. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
and this last one is, hold on to your butt.
Okay.
Number 10, two people cannot abuse each other. Abuse happens when one person exerts power over another in order to control the outcome of activities. Thus, one person abuses another person.
Yes.
You know what I thought of? I thought of Amber Heard and Johnny Depp.
That's immediately what I thought of.
Did you think of that too?
I did. I was
because
like, that's people framed it that way.
That they were abusing each other.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't, I'm really curious how that would work out. This is where I'd want like to talk through stuff with Christy. If only she was available for the podcast to talk through this kind of stuff.
We have her on every week now, so it's fine.
But I was thinking, like, you know, if my 4-year-old throws a fit and right. flails his arms and hits me in the head, mm-hmm. that's not abuse.
Right.
Right? If right. I throw a fit.
Right.
Even though and hit the 4-year-old in the head with my arm.
Right.
That's abuse.
Yeah. So
that's
kind of
what
violence,
she's getting at. That's what she's
not all
getting
violence
at.
Is abuse, then, is one way that we maybe say that. So two people could get into a violent altercation and it wouldn't be abuse.
Yeah.
Two people can get into a fight.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is what Sarah Schulman, she uses one of these examples in her book, Conflict is Not Abuse, which, by the way, I highly recommend as well. Mm-hmm. She talks about how in intimate partner violence in Canada, she says, and she works primarily with the LGBTQ population. She said there'll be one person who's very, very abusive mm-hmm. towards the other person. And then the other person finally fights back or pushes them away right. or uses force to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. The abusive person gets hurt, calls the police on the person who protected themselves, and the person who protected themselves gets taken away in the cop car.
Yep.
You remember that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she ratchets that up to the geopolitical level as well. She says this is, you know, Israel and Palestine. This is yes. like international conflict works this way as well.
Yes. Yes.
But yeah. Yeah. Which is an abusive action. Yes. Like using the police as your...
The power of the state.
Yeah.
To enforce your way.
Yeah.
And I guess I bring these things up just to say, like, we have intuitions on a lot of things. You know, mm-hmm. she mentioned like not walking into walls because they hurt us. but our intuitions and instincts on power and abuse and control are just not so great.
Right.
They're just not so great.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking as a white, powerful, cisgendered, able-bodied, ADHD, neurospicy man.
Right. Yeah. And they're not great probably like for good reason. Like we just haven't had to reckon with these things. And so we're just, you know, we're just learning to.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's like, you're not bad if you don't know about this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, but you are ignorant. And so go ahead and learn, you know?
Yeah. Like, go ahead and
let's
learn.
Let's learn as fast as we can.
Yeah.
You know, how to recognize these power dynamics that have so far eluded us that have, you know, kept people in harmful situations. Like, let's learn. Let's learn how to recognize when the abusive person is, you know, becoming the victim. Let's learn how to recognize that.
Yeah.
You know? So. In Jesus' name.
In Jesus' name.
For Jesus' sake.
Yes.
So.
Well, that'd be great.
That'd be great if we did that. Let's do it.
If we did that.
Let's do it, everybody.
Yeah. Hey, did I tell you that I talked to my dad this past weekend?
No, you didn't mention
it. And he told me that when he dies, he wants his ashes pressed into a record.
Wow. That's unusually hip for your dad.
Yeah.
I mean, I know him a little bit, so yeah.
It was his vinyl request.
I knew something was coming, but vinyl request.
It's pretty good, right?
I actually started thinking about that. I was like, could you do that?
Yeah, right.
Or would it just, it probably couldn't. It would just crumble. You'd probably have to mix them with like real vinyl or something.
Yeah. By the time we pass away, Ben, Lord willing, maybe let's say 30 years, 40 years for me, 30 for you.
Wait, 30 years.
Oh, yeah.
That'll
be a good run. You'll be 78.
78. I want to live into my 80s or 90s, man.
Well, maybe you will.
78. Jeez.
Maybe you will.
40. I'm calling it 40 years.
Okay, 40 for you, 50 for me.
why do you get more years?
I just keep giving myself more years. I don't know. I wonder what they'll be able to do with our carbon. Mm. Like, I really do wonder what families will do with the carbon of their deceased people. Because let's just say a half century. You've got to think, or even like the DNA of the deceased people, that there will be some options of transhumanistic consciousness transfer or some kind of hybrid bio thing. Like we're going to grow a tree that has dad's DNA in it.
I feel like I've read some sci-fi novels that have ideas like this in them. So
this is pretty far away from Dr. Gunter's research.
Yeah, I don't know how we got here. What was your silly joke? Yeah,
all right, everybody.
That was what it was. All right.
Until next time.
Yes. Peace.
Sayonara.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, we'd love it if you'd tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
Joining our Gravity community is free. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our show is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast, and you can check out his work at aaronsternke.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the Start Record button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.